where, you remember, where Drona had gone to King Drupada, and he had wanted Drupada to give him the work he had promised him when they were young boys. And when Drupada refused, Drona stalked out, but he did not forget. And now, a long time later, Drona feels that the time has come for him to be able to go back to Drupada, not as a beggar, but as a conqueror. So anyway, there's a principle called Guru Dakshina. Guru Dakshina is what you owe the Guru for what the Guru has given to you. It's the payment that you have to offer the Guru. And so Drona has been the Guru in the art of warfare to both the Kauravas, Duryodhana and his brother, and the Pandavas, Yudhishthira and all of the five Pandavas. And now Drona realizes that he has trained these young soldiers to such an extent that they have the power to be his instrument, to go back to this man who has insulted him so profoundly and right the wrong that Drona feels has been done to him. Now, remember, Drona represents the power of past habits, of samskars, and Drupada represents a disinclination, a spiritual aspiration, a disinclination for material things. And they start out as friends, as we find in our lives, but then the power of past habit tries to interrupt your spiritual life, and Drona had rejected him, and that's the symbolic story here. But the symbolism is not so important, it was just a part of it. Okay. So, yes. I'm sorry. Drona is the teacher of archery. He's not related to anyone. He's just himself. He's the one who came, and Bhishma hired him to train the boys to be great warriors. He's the one who had such an affection for Arjuna, even greater than for his own son, Ashwatthama. And Ashwatthama, his own son, keeps siding with Duryodhana. Drona keeps trying to get him to side with Arjuna. And so finally, when the final battle takes place, Ashwatthama and Drona are fighting, have to fight for the Kauravas. Drona has to fight for the Kauravas because past habits tend to lean toward material desire. But in the story, it's because he's lived in their household all this time and he owes it to them to fight. His heart is with the Pandavas, and he often tells Duryodhana, you don't have a chance, and I'm only fighting with you because I'm obligated to, not because I really think that you have the righteous cause. Because by that time, samskaras have gotten on the side of spirit, but still they're trapped where they always used to be, and they have to be obliterated by the Pandavas, is how it finally ends up working. Does that help? Okay. So Drona now, as the teacher of these all these soldiers, says, I have an assignment for you, and you have to do it. And of course, they're very eager to do this, because this is going to be their first real battle. And Duryodhana, in his usual self-important manner, says to the Pandavas, you know, we don't even need you. We can do this all by ourselves. And the Pandavas are just perfectly happy to let him go ahead and try. So the Kauravas, which is Duryodhana and his people, go out into the kingdom of Drupada, and they challenge Drupada, and they say that they're there on behalf of Drona, and they're just going to challenge him. And so, you know, the kings are always ready to defend their honor. That's just the way it always works. So they go out and they do their very best, but Drupada is very, very powerful because he represents the disinclination for material things. And so when material desire assaults him, he has a lot of power against that force. And what happens is that Drupada's forces rout the army of Duryodhana, which, you know, was one of the things that further humiliates Duryodhana. And finally, Arjuna says to Yudhishthira, we don't even need all five of us, just four of us can go, you can just sit this one out. So Arjuna leads the other three of his brothers, Bhima and Nakula and Sahadev. And Arjuna, being this great warrior with the archery and the arrows, he just creates a shower of arrows that completely overpower Drupada's army, and they just cut right through it. And Drona's instructions are exact. He said, I do not want Drupada harmed. I want you to capture him, bind him, and bring him to me. So Drupada is amazed to see these warriors, especially Arjuna, coming to him, and he's completely captured and overpowered, and there's nothing his army can do against the army of the Pandavas when they're attacked that way. So they bind up Drupada, and they bring him to Drona. Now, Drona has been waiting his whole life for this moment, and he said, I asked you to fulfill your childhood promise to me, and you refused. So now I own you, your life, is at my mercy, and all of your possessions I have now conquered. He said, but I don't want everything from you. I just want you to keep the word that you gave to me as a child. He said, so I will give half the kingdom to you, and I will take half of it. And so he gave Drupada everything that was north of a certain line, and Drona took possession of everything that was south of that line. Now, the way Master describes that is that samskaras and past habits own the lower chakras, and spiritual aspiration can own the higher chakras, but the kingdom is divided until we are self-realized. And so this is the story of Drona and Drupada acted out again. Then Drona ordered that Drupada be released, and he embraced him and assumed that, well, now it's all even and now it's all over, not remembering that the anger of a kshatriya lasts for a long time. The anger of a Brahmin, Drona was a Brahmin, just flares up quickly but then goes away. So without a word, Drupada has now been humiliated by Drona, but he's not going to let this challenge go unresponded to. So he goes away and he goes off into the forest. And these epics are wonderful because they're always telling you, you have a problem, you go to the forest and you do austerities. And if you do sufficient austerities, you will please the powers that be in the form of the gods or whatever it may be, and they will appear to you and they will grant you boons. And sort of one of the, there's all these little sub-themes of these stories which I love, which is being granted boons, where you please the divine force, and the divine force will help you. And you observe that good people and bad people can get boons because all of them can activate divine power. It's not just a factor of following certain rules. It's just having that concentration and that determination that the divine force lends its energy. It's pleased by tapasya, regardless of who offers it. And once again, we see sort of the complexity of this story. So Drupada makes a very strong resolution. He has two desires now. The first desire is he recognizes that Drona is a very powerful warrior, made more powerful by the alliances he's formed. But Drupada wants his revenge. And he's determined, he says, he wants to give birth, he wants to have a son. He wants to have a son with enough power to be able to destroy Drona. And then he also is so entranced and so impressed by the power of Arjuna that he would like to pay homage to this great warrior and to make an alliance with this great lawyer, so he also wishes to have a daughter that he can offer in marriage to Arjuna. So he goes off, and for a long period of time he does tapasya, and finally he gets the rishis to perform for him a great fire sacrifice. And in the middle of this sacrifice, they invoke the power of the infinite. And out of the fire comes his son, whose name is called Drishtadyumna. Drishtadyumna, which means extreme, the calm inner light. And he's the offspring of extreme dispassion. Drupada means extreme dispassion, disinclination for the things of this world. And the offspring of that, born out of the inner light, is this, out of the inner fire of devotion and dedication, is the calm inner light. And the calm inner light has the power to obliterate your samskaras and to break your past habits. So this son is born to defeat the force of the past. This calm inner light will be able to do that. So Drishtadyumna is born with the one purpose, out of the sacrificial fire of vanquishing Drona when the battle day finally comes. And also out of this fire is born a daughter, and her name is Drupadi. And Drupadi is the power of the Kundalini, the power of feeling, the power of spiritual energy. And this daughter is born to marry Arjuna. So now Drupada has set in motion all these other forces that will eventually bear fruit at the time of the Great War. Okay, and also, of course, you know, this calm, extreme dispassion anchored in tapasya and spiritual practice gives rise to the Kundalini. So again, the other offspring is the expression of Kundalini is the result of Drupada's self-discipline. So it's factual for the story, and it's also symbolic. Now, meanwhile, back in Hastinapura, Duryodhana is quite distressed because once again he's been humiliated by the Pandavas. And once again the people are praising the Pandavas for their great powers. Even four of them accomplished what Duryodhana and all his brothers could not accomplish. Plus, the Pandavas are very popular. They're beautiful, they're kind, they radiate great spiritual energy, and naturally the people are very much attracted to him. And Yudhishthira is the oldest, and Dhritarashtra realizes that there's, even though he doesn't like it, you know, it's only appropriate that certain, that he honor them and recognize them for the truth of who they are. And also Dhritarashtra has to say to Duryodhana, you know, I'm but a blind king, I am king in name only. The one who really conquered and created this kingdom was my brother Pandu, who is the father of the Pandavas. And Yudhishthira is the oldest son, and it's only right that he should have a place in this kingdom. I simply cannot cut him out. So they decide that they have to crown Yudhishthira Yuvraj, which is they declare him the heir. And Duryodhana hates every bit of it and is just furious, but nonetheless they have to sort of put on a face about unity, and because it's not seemly to be arguing among the cousins, and they have to pretend to be happy about this. But Duryodhana becomes more and more obsessed with the humiliation of having to live under the Pandavas. And every day he goes to his father and he complains about the oppression of the Pandavas and how they're going to be beggars in their own home. And he projects upon the Pandavas all his own faults, which is what the materialistic side of our nature tends to do about the spiritual side. We imagine that it's going to ruin us, that it's going to hurt us, that it's not going to be kind to us, that we're not going to have anything we want. And finally Duryodhana persuades his father. He says, look, if we can just get rid of them for a year, he said, I will be able to exert my charm on the people. I will be able to become so popular that when the Pandavas come back, no one will really be interested in them anymore. So he begs his father to send them away. And finally his father agrees that perhaps it's a good plan. But Dhritarashtra is afraid that while they're away, Duryodhana will hatch some harebrained scheme like he did with tying up Bhima that will just bring dishonor on their house and will be ineffective. So Dhritarashtra decides that it's up to him, that in order to save his son from this great humiliation, and even Duryodhana has persuaded him that the Pandavas present a great threat to him, even though they've always been respectful. Now, this is not untrue, because the material desire and the ignorance of the mind is profoundly threatened by spirituality. And even though spirituality may offer to coexist, material desire knows that spiritual aspiration will eventually obliterate it. And it will never get to enjoy itself if the kingdom is ruled by the higher consciousness. So Yudhishthira is trying to compromise. Oftentimes the devotee in the early stages thinks it can compromise, thinks it can have a little bit of both. But the other side, the materialistic side, actually knows how strong the threat is, and that's why it puts up such a big fight. So Dhritarashtra hatches this plot. And he decides that he's going to send them off to this city called Varnavata, which is just another place. And he invites Yudhishthira in and the Pandava brothers, and he tells them what a beautiful city it is. Wouldn't it be wonderful to go there and visit for a while? And we're having a great palace built there for you, and our citizens in that city would be so pleased. And the Pandavas know that there's something fishy going on here. But Yudhishthira has resolved not to create disharmony, but to try in every way to cooperate and thus to avert the calamity of having to have a showdown with his own family. So they go to this city, and while they're on their way to this city, while they're leaving Hastinapura, and the citizens are very distressed about their going because they're not sure. They sense that there's something uneasy. But Yudhishthira and the Pandavas act as if this is all just a happy holiday. And Vidura, who's privy to the counsel of both sides, goes up to Yudhishthira and he speaks to him in a very unusual dialect, which becomes a code between them. And he speaks to them about all the possible ways in which life can be taken. And Kunti, his mother, who's walking with him, says later, what did he talk about? He said, well, he warned me about poison and about fire. He said, but Vidura thinks that it's going to be fire. And Vidura talked about how you protect yourself, how even animals burrow into the ground, and then even when a fire rages above ground, they're safe underneath the ground. So they arrive in this new city, and they see this beautiful palace. But privately, they walk around and they observe. It's a beautiful house built with a moat around it. But they observe that there's something very strange about this house. And they realize that it's been built of very flammable materials. They call it it's all wax and wood and has a sort of an odd smell to it. And this agent of Dhritarashtra's is there sort of looking out for them. Puruchana is his name. But they decide that they'll bide their time. And so a man appears after a time saying he's sent by Vidura, and he speaks to Yudhishthira from the same dialect. And then Yudhishthira knows that he's been sent and he can be trusted. And it turns out that he's a mining engineer. And he begins the project of creating a tunnel that they tunnel out from under the palace way out into the forest, and very surreptitiously, because Purochana, Dhritarashtra's agent, is around. They know there's spies around, and they very surreptitiously, this miner begins to dig this big tunnel out from under the house, out under the house and out into the forest. And Yudhishthira and his brother spend a lot of time hunting in the woods and riding and exploring because they want to get a strong sense of what the land is like. And almost a year passes. And then Yudhishthira, the tunnel is finally ready, and Yudhishthira decides that they had better take the initiative rather than waiting for Dhritarashtra's agents to act. So Puruchana has a friend who's also an evil person engaged with him in this, and she's a woman and she has 5 sons, and they invite Puruchana and the woman and her 5 sons all to a big feast, and they feed them lots of wine, which has been spiked with a sleep-inducing drug. And then after this woman and her 5 sons and Dhritarashtra's agent all pass out from the excess of wine, then Yudhishthira himself sets the palace on fire. But as soon as he sets it on fire, the family goes into the tunnel and they escape out through the tunnel, and the building immediately goes into enormous flames, and the 7 people inside of it are incinerated in the fire. But the Pandavas have actually escaped. And then others, the citizens, all rush to it, but nothing can be done because the flammable materials are so quick to ignite. And finally, when it's burned and it's cooled, the agent of Dhritarashtra, the miner, sort of looks around carefully, and he sees that the tunnel had been opened and then debris has collapsed into it, and they count the bodies of the 5 men and the 1 woman, and then they announce to the world that the Pandavas have been killed in this tragic accident. And Dhritarashtra and Duryodhana have to hold a funeral service, and they have to act so distressed, but of course secretly they're overjoyed. And meanwhile the Pandavas have escaped underneath, and they get to the river, and they find waiting for them is a ferryman and a boat. And he said, every night for many months I have been coming to this river. He said, I received a message from Vidura to wait here every night, and that one of these nights the Pandavas would come and that I would have the privilege of taking you across the river. And that he also told me that I must send word to Vidura but never speak of this, that it happened. So Vidura gets word that the Pandavas have escaped, and he sees that the one who is so truly distressed is Bhishma, who had looked to the Pandavas. He's the ego, and he had looked to the Pandavas as the spiritual force to eventually rescue him, and he's just heartsick to be trapped here only with Duryodhana, who represents material desire, and all his aspirations for freedom are dashed. And Vidura sees how sad he is, so he whispers in his ear that, do not be dismayed. I have reason to believe that the Pandavas have escaped. But they keep the knowledge to themselves. So now the Pandavas have to go into hiding, because once again they realize that Duryodhana is out to kill them, and they know that they flee into the forest, and they meet the sage Vyasa, who, of course, as a sage in charge of the development of the planet, is keeping track of how all these forces are working. So he intersects the Pandavas, and he speaks to Yudhishthira and to the brothers, and he gives them advice. He says, the time is not ripe yet for you to assert your power, that you must wait in abeyance, and then the time will come. Now, this is also true advice sometimes for spiritual battles that we have to fight, isn't it? Even though ultimately we know that the spiritual dimension of our nature may triumph, we have to pick and choose the right moment for that battle. If we confront our own faults and our own delusions prematurely, often they will defeat us. Yogananda himself said, the better part of wisdom and valor is when you're faced with a test that you know you can't pass, is to run away. It's a very interesting statement, because you don't want to develop a habit of being defeated. Better to avoid the battle if you know you're going to lose than to face it when defeat is certain. So Vyasa advises them, the time is not right. And he says, you know, and he gives them advice that's good for everyone. He said, even the virtuous suffer sometimes. Nobody's life is unalloyed, uninterrupted good fortune. You know, misfortune comes even to the best and most virtuous of people. So he says, just face it calmly, face it bravely. So once again, we think, well, you know, sometimes, yeah, we just have to go and hide in the forest for a while. Too much has happened to us. We have to go incognito. So he suggests that they go live in this town called Ekachakra and just hide out there, waiting for a more auspicious moment to reveal that they're still alive. And then there's a lot of little adventures thrown in here, and here's one that is interesting. While they were resting in the forest, passing through the forest, they came upon this beautiful lake, and the five brothers and their mother, Kunti. And they were weary from making their way through the forest and traumatized from the events of the past day. So they camped there for a time and decided to rest. Unknown to them, however, that lake was under the control of a fearsome Rakshasa. Now, Rakshasa is a particular kind of demon who appears periodically. Rakshasas have a great deal of power. They can change their form. They can look beautiful. They can look ugly. They can fly. They can fight at night. And only very powerful mortals have the capacity to fight against Rakshasas. The dark forces are divided up and characterized just as the light forces are too. So this Rakshasa, whose name was Hidimba, had a sister whose name was Hidimbi. Okay? And Hidimba sent his sister Hidimbi to kill the mortals that he found trespassing in his area and to bring their carcasses to him so he could eat them. Rakshasas are, you know, fearsome creatures who eat other creatures. And so Hidimbi had carried out this duty for her fierce brother many times before, and she crept up to where they were camping. But when she got there, she saw Bhima. Now, Bhima had a magnificent physique, and he was, you know, twice or three times the size of an ordinary man, and he had these wonderful muscles, and he just radiated this great strength and this impulsive, powerful energy. And Hidimbi was immediately struck in love. And far from wanting to kill this mortal and take him home to be her brother's dinner, she wanted to win this mortal man to be her own sweetheart. Now, a Rakshasa in his natural form, or her natural form, is really quite ugly to the human eye, but they have the power to transform. So she transformed herself into this delicate and beautiful maiden. And she came to him and she said, you know, I find you the most wonderful man, and I want you to run away with me and come and live with me. She said, I'm very powerful. I can provide everything we need. We can live in comfort and joy effortlessly for the rest of our lives. Bhima said, how can you make such a proposition to me? He said, see, my brothers and my mother, we're fleeing for our lives. I couldn't possibly desert them merely to go off with you. She says, I am a maiden who is offering myself to you. It is not appropriate of you to reject me. This is not right. This is not chivalrous. Once again, Bhima says, I'm sorry, I simply can't. And he finds her attractive, but he says, I can't. I just have this other duty. Now, meanwhile, Hidimbi's brother, Hidimba, is very hungry. And he wonders what's keeping her, because it really should have been a very simple matter to dispatch these mortals and bring them. So he comes crashing through, and all of a sudden, Bhima is confronted with this beautiful maiden on one hand and this terrible Rakshasa on the other. And Hidimbi says, "Oh, no one can fight my brother. We must flee." And Bhima, of course, is afraid of no one. And so he takes on this Rakshasa, and this terrible battle ensues, so intense that it wakes up his brothers and his mother. And they wake up to this very strange sight, which is Bhima fighting fiercely with this Rakshasa, while this young love-struck maiden is standing on the side admiringly, and they're just watching this battle take place. And of course, Bhima is invincible. So he defeats Hidimba and kills him, which Hidimbi doesn't mind all that much, because she's been oppressed, rather, by this brother all this time. And meanwhile, Kunti is observing, and all the brothers are observing, that this maiden seems quite enamored of Bhima. And they begin to tease him a little bit. And Kunti goes and speaks to the maiden, and she confesses that, in fact, she's quite smitten with Bhima, that Bhima has been unwilling, out of a sense of duty to his family, to accept her proposal. And Kunti feels, well, it's not necessary for him to refuse. You know, it's not chivalrous for him to refuse. You understand that the men had many wives in these periods of time. And by now she can also see that Bhima is quite smitten by this woman, knowing that she's also a Rakshasa, but Bhima's a bit of a character himself, so it doesn't matter. And so they make an agreement, and he says, well, I will be your husband, and I will stay with you until we have a son. And then I must go on, because my duty lies elsewhere. So they go off for a time, and after a period of time, a great and powerful son is born. It was Bhima's son with this Rakshasa woman, and his name is called Ghatachoka. I don't know why the people are called these things, but that's his name. Okay? And he becomes very important, because Ghatakocha is his name. Because later on, when the great battle is fought, all the sons and all the relatives and all the allies come together, and this great Rakshasa, half-human, half-Rakshasa warrior, has powers that others don't have. And at a critical point in the great battle, when Dharma has been so disregarded that they continue to fight even after the sun has set, which until then was just such a dishonorable thing to do. No one had ever done it. But this is the beginning of Kali Yuga. This Rakshasa has the power at night. He can fight at night in the ways that mortals can't. And he can fly through the sky. And his energy becomes very important in the defeat of the evil forces. Okay, so now, after that little adventure has passed, and the son has been sired and is launched in his life, Bhima has to leave his heartbroken sweetheart, Hidimbi, but she knew that was the bargain, and he goes off with his family, knowing that he'll see her again and he'll see his son. And they go hide, they disguise themselves as Brahmins, and they become humble beggars. And they go into this town, and they take up humble lodgings, and every day they have to go out and beg for their food. And Bhima, being so much bigger and more, has his appetite is so much larger. Half of everything they beg goes to Bhima. And finally, a potter in town makes a huge begging bowl, which Bhima carries around, and it enables him to have more of what he needs. But they go out every day and they beg, and then they divide what they have and share it with one another, and they live quietly this way for some time. And then one day, they hear the family from whom they have been renting their dwelling is a man and his wife and their son and their daughter. And Kunti hears all this weeping and wailing going on in the house, and there's this sort of argument going on. And the father says, "I will go. I will be the one who will go." And the mother says, "How can we live without you? The children need your protection. I am the one who must sacrifice myself." And then the son says, "No, I am the one." And it turns out that this town is plagued also by a terrible Rakshasa. And this monstrous Rakshasa used to come randomly into the town and kill people and take them away to eat them for food. And finally, the town made a bargain with the Rakshasa, which is once a week, one family would sacrifice one member of their family, and that person would fill a cart full of food, and then that individual would drive the food to the Rakshasa's cave. The Rakshasa would eat the food and the person, And in this way, the town would not be tyrannized anymore. So, unfortunately, the lot had fallen on this family of four, and they were talking back and forth about who should sacrifice themselves. And finally, they all decided that none could live without the other, and so that all four of them would go. And Kunti said, "We have taken your hospitality and lived in your home all this time." He said, "It's not right. I will volunteer. I have five sons. You have but one son and one daughter. I'll volunteer one of my sons." And at first they refused to accept her generous offer, but she absolutely insisted. So when her sons came home, she told them what she had done, and Bhima, of course, was the one who wanted to go, not the least of which is because he got a whole cart full of food. So the woman of the house filled this cart with delicious food, and Bhima went off pretending great sorrow because they're masquerading as Brahmins. You know, Bhima's reputation is well known, and they can't expose. A Brahmin would not have the power to fight a Rakshasa like Bhima has, and they're hiding out now. They're still keeping their identity secret. So Bhima goes off, and they pretend as if it's a sorrowful occasion, but no one is concerned for Bhima's well-being. And he gets to the cave of the Rakshasa, and before he announces his presence, he realizes he has this whole wonderful cart of food, and he realizes that if he spills the blood of the Rakshasa, he will be polluted and will not be able to enjoy this wonderful meal. So it's necessary for him to eat it first. So he sits quietly outside the cave of the Rakshasa, and for the first time practically since they've been there, he has all he wants to eat, and he's very, very satisfied. And just as he's finishing, of course, the Rakshasa sees and bellows out and accuses him, "What are you doing? That food belongs to me. This is my town. Who are you to flagrantly disregard the agreement? The people of that town will pay." And Bhima just says, "Just a moment, I'm not quite finished." And then he finishes what little food is left, and then he engages the Rakshasa, and of course, after a fearsome battle, he wins. And then he takes the mangled form of the Rakshasa and he puts it in front of the gate so that the people in the town will know that they are forever free of this Rakshasa. Then he dons the clothes of a Brahmin again and disappears back into the house. Now, that little bit of action was exposing themselves a little bit, and they knew it was a little bit dangerous because word would spread. And they also knew that they, to a certain extent now, would be regarded very differently in this small town. And right at the same time, a great event is happening in another part of the country, and word reaches them. And this is now Drupada, the king who was defeated by Drona, who resolved to have the son to kill Drona and the daughter to give to Arjuna. It's time for the daughter to be married. And so they're going to hold, remember the ceremony that we've had before, the Swayamvara. And that was where, remember, Bhishma went before and he got the three sisters, and one of the sisters was already promised. Well, Draupadi is going to have a Swayamvara, and her brother Drishtadyumna is going to preside over it, and her father. And Drupada has heard rumors that the Pandavas are not really dead. And he wants to draw, if they exist, if they're still alive, he wants them to come to this great event. Now, this is an event in which the woman gets to choose her own spouse. And she can set any standards that they like. It can be a competition of skill, or she can just simply choose by any standard that she wants. It's her decision. She offers the garland, and that becomes her husband. Well, so the runners are going out, and they're talking all about this great Swayamvara that's going to take place, and that the Draupadi is the most exquisitely beautiful woman in all of the land, and the family of Draupadi is very powerfully placed, and he just wants the word out just in case, you know, that Arjuna is somewhere. So as soon as the brothers hear about this, Kunti senses that they all have this desire to go and compete for this bride. And so she doesn't want to embarrass them or force them to have to ask. So she says, "This town is growing tiresome." She said, "This event seems interesting. Why don't we go?" And in this sort of delicate way, she spares them the need of having to assert their own will against their mother. So they go to this extraordinary event, and everyone is there, including Krishna. This is the first time Krishna enters the story. Okay? Because Krishna knows intuitively that the Pandavas are still alive, of course. And he has come to this event because he knows that Draupadi is destined to be the bride of Arjuna, And so he's there, and he's in the audience, and he's watching this crowd of people come, and he's with his brother, and he's making comments to his brother. And suddenly he sees, sort of one at a time, these five extraordinary individuals disguised as Brahmins, but whose radiance and power does not seem at all Brahmin-like. And he sees that they've all come in, and he says to Balarama, "See, Arjuna, Yudhishthira, Bhima," like this. So the contest is going on, and the contest is not an easy one. There's a very powerful bow there. And to compete for the possibility of marrying this woman, taking her as a bride, you have to first be able to string this bow, and then you have five arrows, and you have a very difficult target, which is very high up in a tree and very small, and you have to pierce that target with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 arrows. And only if you succeed in doing that are you able to have Draupadi as your bride. And so every great warrior makes an attempt. And some come very close, you know, frighteningly close. Karna tries, and he manages. He's powerful enough to string the bow, and he shoots the arrows, but he misses the target by just a hair. He can't quite do it. And now everyone has tried, and even if the great Karna can't succeed, and this sort of rumbling is beginning to happen, "The contest is too hard. You never intended to give the bride away. You called us here. This is a sham. This was not fair." And then out of the section where the Brahmins are sitting, this powerful man stands up and he says, "Can a Brahmin compete?" And Drishtadyumna says, "Anyone can compete. It's an open competition." And of course, Krishna says, "This is no Brahmin. This is Arjuna." And so Arjuna goes and he strings the bow and he picks it up and all five of the arrows pierce the target. And it's a Brahmin. Draupadi is very distressed. He doesn't recognize him. He just thinks that something has happened here. And so Draupadi, according to what she has said, she puts the garland around him, and now this is her husband. And the Brahmin, Arjuna, starts to take her away. And suddenly there's a great outcry from all the Kshatriyas. "This is not right. This was a Kshatriya contest. How can a Brahmin take her away? She was meant for us." And there's this sort of, and then all the five Pandavas gather together, and there's this great force suddenly facing all the Kshatriyas. But before it really comes to blows, Krishna intervenes. He said, "No one objected before he won. Only after he won have you called it unfair." And then cooler heads prevail, and the conflict is averted. Now, Draupadi is very depressed, but Drishtadyumna, the calm inner light, has a feeling that something really wonderful has happened here. The Kundalini has now been united with the five chakras, is what's happened here. And Drishtadyumna can feel that. So Arjuna leads Draupadi away, and Drishtadyumna follows to see what's happening. And they come to this little place where they've been staying, and Kunti had stayed behind because it wasn't seemly for a woman to be at that tournament. This was for the men. And as they're coming closer, one of the brothers calls out, "Mother, we have brought home the most wonderful thing." And they called out the way, "Something wonderful has been given to us." And that's what they would say every day when they would come home with their whatever they had been begging for through their lives living as begging Brahmins. And she says, "Well, my sons, of course, share it equally among you." And then when they get inside, she realizes that what they have brought home is this woman. And yet she has made this very peculiar statement that this woman must be shared equally among you. But Kunti has never said an untruth. And the sons also respect the word of their mother as if it were the word of the divine. So their mother has spoken, and Kunti has never spoken an untruth. And these words have come out of her mouth. And Yudhishthira also then confesses that he had had a slight desire for this woman. And he found it difficult to reconcile that because he was so pure in his nature that he'd never had an improper desire. And yet the thought had entered his mind that he wanted this woman for his wife also. And so now they're faced with this great dilemma. And Drishtadyumna is listening, and he hears them talk, and he hears the voice of Kunti, and he hears the brothers discussing, and he realizes that indeed these are the Pandavas. And in fact, just as his father had intended, this woman has attracted Arjuna and has become one with Arjuna. So Drishtadyumna went home and told his father, and a great message is sent to the home where the Pandavas are staying, and she invites them to the palace, and let us have a great and glorious wedding worthy of a king and a king's daughter and the princes of this house. And then the brothers arrive, and they inform Drupada that, yes, absolutely, she will be the bride of Arjuna, and also of Yudhishthira and Bhima and Nakula and Sahadev. And of course, Drupada is horrified at this, because even though men can have many wives, it is very, very uncommon for a wife to have many husbands. So they're just simply, they don't know what to do. So they consult Vyasa. And Vyasa consults the scripture and finds, yes, that it is unusual, but it can happen. And so the decision is made. Now, symbolically, the way Master explains this, Drupadi is the energy of the Kundalini. And the five Pandavas represent the five chakras. And they have to unite. He has to unite with all of them. The Kundalini is not meant to be just the expression of only one of the chakras. It has to be equally united with all the chakras and expressed through all of them. So we have this peculiarity. Whether it was really part of the actual historical story or not, none can say. The other brothers, from time to time, take other brides too. I think she's not their only bride, but she has these five for her husband. Okay. So now the news reaches Hastinapura, Dhritarashtra's court where Duryodhana is, and Vidura comes in and he announces to Dhritarashtra, an alliance has been formed between our house and the house of Drupada. And Dhritarashtra, he says this in a very clever way, and Dhritarashtra is thrilled that this alliance has been formed because he thinks that his son Duryodhana has won the bride. And then when he is excited about the alliance, Vidura says, the Pandavas are not in fact dead. They have reappeared, and now they have allied themselves with Drupada. Now Duryodhana is absolutely furious. Not only have his enemies escaped this burning house, but now when they reappear, they're even more powerful because the chakras have now aligned themselves with the Kundalini, with the power of Drupada and Drishtadyumna, with the inner light, with the power of extreme dispassion. And these are all the forces that are arrayed now against attachment to material desire. And so Duryodhana knows, you know, that the threat is becoming more and more intense, and that the possibility of him continuing to rule the kingdom of consciousness is really getting smaller and smaller. So there's a tremendous argument goes on with Dhritarashtra and Duryodhana and Karna and all the different ones, and they keep trying to come up. Karna wants to fight constantly. His battle is always very direct. He just wants to go out and go to war with them. But Bhishma says absolutely it can't be done. Again, the ego says it's not time for the final battle. You may think you have the power to overcome them, but you do not. More than that, he says, half this kingdom belongs to them. It's only right. You cannot seize it all for yourself. We must welcome them. Drona also concurs. Even the Samskars say, look, we have to share it. You know, we can't just divide it up at this point. Karna is enraged. He wants what he wants. He wants his happiness in this world the way he wants it. And he insults Drona and tells him that he's a coward and he's just taking the hospitality of this house but has no real loyalty to it. His loyalty is to the Pandavas. And then Drona says, you are acting like a friend to Duryodhana, but you are sending him down a pathway that's going to lead to his destruction. He will end up with nothing. And this is, again, the desire to be happy in this world often completely clouds our judgment, and we end up with nothing if we're not willing to take life as it comes to us. So Bhishma says we have to welcome them. Vidura says all your efforts to kill them are futile. Now they have allied themselves not only with Drupada, Drishtadyumna, Draupadi, but also with Krishna himself. You have no chance. You must face what's happening. So Vidura is sent to Drupada's kingdom to bring them back. And they're very, very suspicious about it. But Yudhishthira feels he must make every effort to have harmony. Yudhishthira is very reluctant to create disharmony, so they all go to Hastinapura, including Krishna. Drupadi is welcomed and is taken into the apartments where the women are. And Gandhari, you remember, she's the wife of Dhritarashtra, and when she married the blind king, she put a handkerchief around her neck. And her tapasya and her sacrifice of her own eyesight so as not to be more elevated, more capable than her husband, gives her great spiritual power and great insight. And she puts her arms around Draupadi to welcome her, and then suddenly steps back like that and says, "This is a poisonous a snake which has been let into our house." And she begins to weep. She says, "This woman will be the death of all my sons." Because she senses, because she also represents the Kundalini. And the rising Kundalini energy is the death of all our lower desires. So as soon as she touches it, she knows that that's what's going to happen. So Dhritarashtra decides that they will divide the kingdom in half. He will give to the Pandavas half the kingdom to rule. And so with great flowery speeches and much ceremony, they make over half the kingdom to Yudhishthira. Of course, they give them this barren half of the kingdom, which was cursed by the rishis years ago, and nothing has been able to flower or flourish there all this time. But Yudhishthira, without complaint, is willing to accept it. And so they go off to a place called Indraprastha, and that's where they go. However, when righteousness enters even a barren wilderness, it becomes a paradise. So for the next 36 years, how the story is told, the Pandavas live happily in their half, and Duryodhana lives in his half, and the Pandavas, with the help of divine forces, gradually transform their part into a paradise. And they build especially, well, I'll explain it in just a moment. So time passes. Just a moment, a second. Yes, okay. Time passes, and it is the job of kings not to be content, you know. It's never enough. You can never just sort of take what you have. The kshatriya must always be expanding his territory and expanding his power. And at the urging of his brothers, and even of Krishna, they urge him, he needs to... I seem to have lost a section here. I was just looking for where it was. Give me a pause here. Okay. So they decide that Yudhishthira is going to be... They want to crown Yudhishthira emperor. And what that's really saying is that the other kings will acknowledge that he's even the leader of the kings. And a great ceremony is held where they release a white horse. This is how it was described. And the white horse wanders from kingdom to kingdom, and the army follows the horse. And wherever the horse wanders, whoever the kings there has to acknowledge the sovereignty of the arriving horse, or they do battle of the one who's going to declare himself emperor. So most of the kings agree because they see that Yudhishthira is self-evidently the recognized leader. But a few evil kings resist and have to be defeated. Duryodhana does not contest it, even though it rankles profoundly with him. He does not feel that he can contest it because, after all, Yudhishthira is the eldest in his line. So this one king, however, has to be subdued. And this is just, again, one of these little side stories. And this king is called Jarasandha. And Jarasandha had a very peculiar beginning in his life. See, because one of the jobs of kings also is to obliterate the evil. The job, the honor of a kshatriya is dependent upon his willingness to stand up and defeat the evil forces. And Jarasandha is a very evil king. And his birth came about in a most peculiar way, which is that his father, they did not have any offspring. He had two wives, and neither of his wives ever had a child. And the king became quite distressed over this, because their job is to expand their territory and to create sons. So he did a great tapasya again, and in the result, the fruit of his penance was that this magical fruit was given into his hands, and it was a mango. And the divine being who gave it to him said, you know, give this to your wife, and your wife will then bear a strong and a powerful son. But he had two wives. So he took the mango and he split it in half, and he gave half of it to each of them. And then subsequently each of his wives became pregnant and they gave birth to a male child, but each of them gave birth to only half a child because each had only eaten half of the mango. So the two halves of the child were discarded, you know, in great great fear, and it was a horrible event that had happened. But they were the halves were thrown away together. When they were thrown away together, they joined back together again. And then all of a sudden, you had the whole child. And so this son was raised. But there was a curse upon him, and he was a dark soul, and he was very evil. And many, many brave Kshatriyas had died trying to defeat him. And Krishna knew that it was time for him to be defeated. And one of the reasons he urged Yudhishthira to take on this ceremony of being an emperor was so that they could go and confront this evil force and fight against him. And so they knew that they couldn't necessarily win by challenging him, his armies, because his armies were very powerful. But what Krishna advised them would be a single combat between Bhima and this one king. So they went in disguised as Brahmins and got an audience with the king. But once they were there, Bhima started insulting the king, and the king said, "You're no Brahmin, who are you?" And he revealed his power as a Kshatriya and challenged this king to single combat, any weapon that you choose. Now, of course, no king can refuse a challenge. That's also part of the code that they have to follow. So the two began to fight. But they were equally matched because Jarasandha was a very powerful man, and they decided, Jarasandha said, "We'll fight, we'll wrestle, we'll just fight with our bare hands." And Bhima was a great wrestler, so they fought and they fought, and the battle went on and on and on and on, and finally, Bhima picks Jarasandha up and he rips him in half, and then he throws the pieces down like that. And then he thinks that he's won and he begins to walk away, but the two pieces come back together again. And Jarasandha rises again and the fight begins again. And so Krishna, standing nearby, just picks up a straw and he casually breaks it in half and then throws the pieces far away from each other. And Bhima sees what Krishna is suggesting to him. So once again, he gets the upper hand and he tears the man in half and he throws the pieces so far away from each other that they can't unite. And so then the man is killed and his kingdom is liberated from the evil destiny presented by him. And the last opposition to Yudhishthira becoming the emperor is eliminated and the great ceremony is set. Now Yudhishthira is ready to have this great ceremony and declare himself emperor. And he's had divine help in building his palace, and they build this great hall for this great event, and it's just exquisitely beautiful. It's, you know, it has mirrors and indoor ponds and, you know, beautiful pillars and courtyards and gardens, and it's just exquisite. And Duryodhana is forced to come and honor his cousin, and he's just eaten up with jealousy. He can hardly bear to be there seeing everybody honoring Yudhishthira when he feels all the honor belongs to him. And Krishna is there, and Krishna comes and again is honored by everyone, but there's this great, Yudhishthira gets to declare, you know, someone that he is going to consider to be the most honorable person at the event. And he, of course, sees Krishna, and he gives all honors to him. And many of the Kshatriyas have this great pride of their position. And at the break, someone asked me, you know, why would the Kshatriyas be mad if the Brahmin got to take the bride? Well, it's about jealousy and pride of position. The Kshatriyas are the warriors, and we're the most important and the most powerful, this everyone thinks. And a mere Brahmin, how could we be defeated by a Brahmin? So that some of these same Kshatriyas who are there because Yudhishthira is too powerful to oppose, but they're not really pure-minded enough to genuinely respect Yudhishthira, who, of course, is this calm spiritual being. They think Duryodhana is really where it's at, and Karna, and so on, naturally. I mean, people follow their own natural vibrations, and they're more attracted. They see Yudhishthira as just kind of a nothing because all his power is inward, and they see Duryodhana, who's got this great investment in the material world, and they see that that's where the real power is. And then Yudhishthira is even more foolish because with all those great kings there, the one he honors is Krishna. Krishna, of course, who grew up as a cowherd, who has no pedigree at all. And now, of course, he has come into his kingdom, but he's just who is Krishna? Because once again, those who are very worldly, when they look at spiritual force, they don't even see it. what's to speak of being attracted to it or inspired to honor it. They just don't even know what's wrong with you. I mean, many people, when Yogananda even was alive, they considered him to be a very... The one man, his famous statement was, oh yes, I know Yogananda, he was a very good cook. Just because they look and they don't see it. You can only see what you are. So there's a great sort of tension about this. And some of the kings actually even walk out. They just have had enough. They don't want to be part of this. But Duryodhana can't leave. But this... So he's walking around this beautiful palace that's been created for this special event. But this palace has been created out of consciousness. It's not merely a material thing. It's also formed with magic. And anybody who's jealous or has bad attitude, this house tricks them. And so Duryodhana is walking around and his inner awareness is so dark that... very bad things keep happening to him. He'll imagine that there's a pond and he'll walk carefully around it and there's nothing there, and so he looks foolish and there will be a pond there, but he's blinded by his jealousy and he can't see it and he falls into it. And Draupadi sees him and she laughs at him. She mocks him. And this great sort of hatred begins to develop in Duryodhana. He wants to humiliate. He can't bear to have his self-esteem and his sense of pride of purpose taken away. Now Vyasa comes also to this great event, and he sees what happens with Duryodhana, and he reads all that's going on, and he says to Yudhishthira, you know, a showdown is inevitable, and there's going to be a terrible bloodbath between these two families. And Yudhishthira just can't bear the thought of having to go to war with his own family and to fight and to kill because he's goodness, he's kindness. He can't understand why there can't be harmony. And he makes this resolution. Vyasa says, there will be a conflict, war is inevitable. And Yudhishthira says, I will do everything in my power to prevent that from happening. And so that explains to a certain extent a few things that happen later, that Vyasa has told him. And he makes somewhat foolish judgments in the hope that he can avert this inevitable destiny. And the example that Yudhishthira's behavior sets is that no matter what we decide with our human minds, if these forces are in play, they're going to act themselves out. So Duryodhana goes home and he just tells everyone in his court and his family about how humiliated he was there and how it rankles to see him have this power, and he wants to attack. And there's this, again, a council, and Karna is always very hot-headed and suggesting they go out and fight, and Vidura is counseling a more sensible course. But Duryodhana this time is determined. And now one of his uncles, Sakuni, who has been here before, Sakuni, who represents, the way Master describes it, is the attachment to the sense of I, right? Sort of a subtle thought. Sakuni is the attachment to I, to being me, right? And that sense of I always gets in, is always supports material desire, because it's the material world that enables us to always sort of be ourselves and be separate and be important. When we enter into the spiritual realm, that sense of I dissolves. So Sakuni is very attached. He represents this attachment. And so he makes a proposition. He says, look, Yudhishthira, he says, has a weakness for gambling. Whether that's a sort of a controversial statement in the Mahabharata as to whether how could Yudhishthira actually have this weakness for gambling, but that's what they say. And he says, besides that, a kshatriya cannot reject a challenge. And Sakuni says, I am a master of playing the dice. He said, and Yudhishthira is just a babe compared to my skill. Duryodhana, you as a king will challenge him to a game of dice, and he will be unable to refuse because it would be dishonorable to refuse. And Bhishma and Vidura and others say, but this is not the ways of kshatriya to gamble like this, to try to win something by means of throwing the dice. But finally, Dhritarashtra is persuaded by Duryodhana, because the blind mind can never resist desire. And Duryodhana desires this with great power, and finally the mind gives in to the desire. And so he consults with Vidura, and Vidura says absolutely that disaster will ensue from this. But Dhritarashtra still can't oppose it. And so Vidura is sent to invite Yudhishthira and his brothers to come to Hastinapura and accept this challenge to this game of dice with Duryodhana. So Vidura arrives there, and he looks very downcast and sad. And Yudhishthira asks him, why, what is so upsetting to you? And Vidura says, I'm here with an invitation from Dhritarashtra and your cousins. And he says that he wants you to come and partake in this game of dice. Yudhishthira says, well, what should I do? And Vidura says, refuse the invitation. And Yudhishthira says, I can't. I am a kshatriya. I have to accept the invitation. Sometimes they say that Yudhishthira, again, had this weakness for gambling. Other explanations of why he accepted are that he knew from Vyasa that conflict was inevitable, and he was determined to give no cause for that conflict to go forth. And even though he knew that this was a foul invitation with a nefarious purpose, he would cooperate with everything that was asked of him in the hope that ultimately there would be no cause for this conflict. So he accepts the invitation. So the Pandavas, together with Draupadi, make the journey to Hastinapura, and a great hall has been set up, and this great gambling event is going to take place. And so they arrive, and they're just about to start, but all of a sudden Yudhishthira sees that Shakuni is playing the dice. And Yudhishthira says, what is this? I was challenged by Duryodhana. He's the one who should play. And Shakuni says, what, are you afraid? Are you a coward? I'm just an elderly man. Why can't you play with me? And Yudhishthira again sees that the fates are against him, and there's no point in disputing it. Now, the lesson of all this, ultimately, is that spirituality should not gamble with material desire. Because the dice are loaded against you. So the game begins. And first, the wagers begin small. They wager jewels. And Shakuni, Yudhishthira throws the dice, Shakuni throws the dice, and each time Shakuni wins, and Duryodhana begins to gloat. So all the jewels are gambled and lost. So then all the gold and the silver goes onto the table, and each side shakes the dice. And again, Shakuni, I have won, you have lost. So then they go to the power of the kingdom. The chariots are put on the table, and the dice are thrown. And again, Shakuni wins. And the horses and the elephants and the armies and the weapons of the army. And then finally the wealth of the people has begun to be wagered. The cows, the sheep, the horses. And then the land of their own kingdom is put on the table, village by village. And each time Yudhishthira throws the dice, and each time Shakuni wins. And everyone is watching silently. And Duryodhana is just becoming filled with a sense of ever-increasing power that this great plan is really going to win. And without having to lift a weapon, he's going to gain possession of the entire kingdom. This is his belief. And the Pandavas, under obedience to their older brother, just have to watch silently while this goes on. So then, piece by piece, every aspect of the kingdom is wagered and lost. And finally, what else is left? And so Yudhishthira begins to remove his personal ornaments, what he is wearing, his own crown. He takes the ornaments and the jewels from his brothers and he puts them on the table. Each time Shakuni throws the dice, each time he wins. And finally they take off the rich clothing that they're wearing and they put it on the table, and each time Shakuni wins. And finally they have nothing left, so it seems. And Shakuni says, well, you still have something to wager. You could wager one of your brothers. So Yudhishthira just thinks in horror, and he wagers Sahadev. And Sahadev is lost. And then he wagers Nakula, and Nakula is lost. And then Shakuni says, well, of course, it was easy for you to wager them, because they are not really even your real brothers. You know, that you gave them away because you don't share a mother. And then, of course, Yudhishthira, because he loves his brothers equally, is goaded, and he wagers Arjuna. And then he wagers Bhima, and all are lost. And finally, the only thing left to wager is himself. So he puts himself as the next wager. Shakuni throws the dice, and Yudhishthira loses. And then everything is gone. their whole kingdom, and they're now slaves to Duryodhana. But Shakuni is not yet satisfied. And he says, oh, you have one jewel left. And Yudhisthira says, we stand naked before you. You own our very bodies. I've wagered my brothers. What's left? You still have Draupadi. And so he wagers Draupadi. And Shakuni throws the dice, and Draupadi is lost. And Duryodhana begins, is just jubilant, and Karna is jubilant, everything now. And so Duryodhana says to Bhadura, go fetch the woman. And the woman, of course, has been in the woman's quarter. She hasn't been witnessing any of this. She's been back where the women live. She's not part of it. And Bhadura says to Duryodhana, you have no idea. You are hanging over an abyss of absolute destruction. I beg you, come to your senses. You cannot, with impunity, insult this powerful woman. You can't toy with the kundalini energy and think that it won't destroy you if your purposes are nefarious. And so, but Duryodhana is just enraged with Vidura for daring to oppose him at this time. So he sends his charioteer. He says, go and fetch the woman. And so he goes there. And Drupada is just absolutely furious. And the charioteer gives the message that Yudhisthira, your husband, has wagered you and lost. He lost himself and he lost you. Now, Draupadi is a woman of great spirit, as you will see as the story goes on. And she just refuses to come. She said, I send a question back to the assembly. And that assembly was, did he wager me before he lost himself or after? In other words, did he have any right to wager me? If he'd already lost himself, he didn't have no right to wager me. So the question comes back. Yudhisthira is silent, and all the brothers are silent. There's nothing they can do. And Duryodhana is just simply furious at her impudence, and so he sends his brother, Dusasana. Dusasana represents anger. When desire is thwarted, anger comes in, right? So he sends his brother to her, and when she once again refuses to come, he's not intimidated by her. He's not a servant of the king. He's the king's own brother. He grabs her by the hair and he drags her in like this. So here, this great queen is dragged in front of this whole assembly and just thrown on the floor like that. But she pulls herself up and she begins to berate all the elders in the room, and she speaks to them one after another. How could you have allowed this outrage? How could you have allowed me to be humiliated in this way? How could you have allowed this evil, adharmic thing to happen? And the Pandavas just have to watch. And finally, Bhima simply cannot stand it. And he turns and he begins to yell at Yudhisthira, how could you be so foolish? Look at what's happening to our queen. And he begins to express his anger toward Yudhisthira. And then Arjuna says, look, he said, their plot is working. We're now turning on one another. And Bhima is so ashamed that he silences himself. But they, because these are kshatriyas, they're not used to being humiliated in this way. They have the power to fight back, but Yudhisthira controls them all and he holds them. He's calmness in the face of battle, in psychological battle. The heart of Bhima and Arjuna want to get into the game, but Yudhisthira remains completely calm in the midst of this battle. So finally, one person, one son of Dhritarashtra, has the sense to protest. And he says, Yudhisthira had already lost himself. He can't wager Draupadi. Besides, she is not his possession alone. She belongs to all the brothers. He had no right to wager her. And suddenly everybody just sort of seems to wake up and realize sort of what's happening here. But Karna doesn't want it to go against Duryodhana. So he stands up, and with his great power, he says, it was not necessary to wage Draupadi separately. He'd already lost everything he owned, including the clothes on his back, and Draupadi was just in that, so he belongs again to Duryodhana. So he says, and even the clothes that Draupadi is wearing belong now to Duryodhana. And so Duryodhana is just overcome with evil, and he says to his brother, take her clothes from her. Now, this is an outrage beyond expression. So Draupadi looks around and sees that no one is going to help her, and she has only one refuge, and she becomes very still, and she begins to appeal to Lord Krishna. And she flees from the scene, puts her mind right on Krishna. Only you, Lord, can save me. So Dushyanta starts pulling on her sari. And he pulls, and he pulls, and he pulls, and he pulls. And no matter how much cloth he takes from her body, there's still more cloth. And this huge pile of fabric builds up around her until they realize that she has fled to Lord Krishna, and Lord Krishna is protecting her. And then, as Bhima is watching this, he cannot act at the time, but he swears a terrible oath, and he says, Dushyanta, I am restrained now by the force of Dharma, but the day will come when I will take your life and I will drink the blood of your bleeding heart. And then Duryodhana is not at all intimidated. And he looks at Draupadi and he said, your words are cheap. He said, they can say whatever they like, but they're my slaves now. He said, but you're a free woman. You can choose a new husband. Look around among the men here and take whichever husband you want. And then, just to provoke the man, he sort of lifts his garment and kind of flashes his thigh at her, as if to say, you know, I am a good specimen. And Bhima again says, I will take my mace and I will break that thigh, like this. And this horror is beginning to build because Duryodhana has gone so far in his disrespect of this power and has no idea what he's working with. And then each of the brothers, except Yudhishthira, one by one makes a solemn vow, and they single out those evil ones in the room, and they describe what a horrible death they will inflict upon them when the day comes, inevitably, when the final battle takes place. And all of a sudden, as Dhritarashtra hears these powerful warriors describing the death of the people in his court and his own sons, he becomes terrified at this late hour. And he sees that Draupadi is the key to what is about to happen. So he suddenly says, you know, stop what is happening. And he has Draupadi brought to him, and he says, my daughter, he says, forgive this terrible outrage against you. I'll grant you a boon, any boon that you like. And so she asks that Yudhishthira be freed. Yes, yes, ask for something else. That the rest of my husbands be freed. Yes, yes, anything else. Two is quite enough, she said. If we are free, that is enough. So Duryodhana is just enraged. He finally pulled this whole thing off, and his stupid father just goes and betrays the whole thing. And so he storms out of the room. He can just hardly believe what his father has done. Yudhishthira speaks respectfully to Dhritarashtra, and Dhritarashtra says, forget that this ever happened, go back to your kingdom. And so Yudhishthira, they're on their way out, and they're traveling back. And Duryodhana now finds his father and comes with Karna. And he says, all this effort, father, to win the kingdom for ourselves, and it was there in our hands, and you gave it back to them. What could you possibly have been thinking? And Dhritarashtra, because he has no power and is completely subject to the desires and the thoughts of this evil son of his, says, oh, I don't know what to do now. And Shakuni says, one more wager. Invite them back for one more wager, and these will be the conditions. He said, we'll put everything on the table, everything back. And whoever wins, wins all of the kingdom, and those who lose must be exiled for 12 years. And they must live in the forest away from the kingdom for 12 years. Then they must spend the 13th year in exile. And then they can come back. So, Yudhishthira is not even quite home before the messenger comes. And the messenger says, one more wager. And Yudhishthira has vowed to do everything he can to avert this conflict. So the helpless pawn of fate, he goes back. And, of course, the conditions are explained to him. The dice is thrown, and Shakuni wins. So now they have been stripped of everything, and they have 12 years in which they must go out into the wilderness, and then they must hide themselves for the 13th year. And if Duryodhana finds them during that 13th year, then they have to be exiled for another 12. Okay. Now, there's a spiritual significance to this, because spiritual evolution and experience tends to take place in 12-year cycles. And if you think back on your life, the ages of 12, 24, 36, 48, 60 are often very key times when great spiritual change takes place. And the other side of it is, if you squander those divine opportunities, often you have to wait another 12 years before the opportunity comes. So once the spiritual forces are exiled, they're exiled for 12 years before they're able to come back again. So immediately they have to leave. And Yudhishthira, and they, as they walk out, Vidura describes to Dhritarashtra the scene, and Yudhishthira has his eyes covered, and Bhima just keeps looking at his hands, folding his hands open and shut like this. And Arjuna has handfuls of sand, and he's scattering it like this. And Draupadi has her hair just hanging loose, and she weeps and wails as she walks out. And all the citizens are just in such distress, but Yudhishthira has lost the wager, and this is what he agreed to do, and therefore this is what he's going to do. And then the symbolism is explained, that the power of Yudhishthira, the anger, would turn the city to ashes, so he covers his eyes so as not to expose them. Bhima is thinking of the vows he has made and how he's going to use his mace in his powerful hands and drink the blood of Dusashana and break the thighs of Duryodhana. And Arjuna, the sand, represents the rain of arrows that are going to come down. And Draupadi is showing what is going to happen to all the women of that town when the great battle comes, and they are cast into mourning, even as she is in mourning now. And then they go off into the forest.